Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. Today, the hometown that we visit is Kingsburg, California, just south of Fresno, home to that great Swedish heritage maybe you've heard of, and home to an 86-year-old Navy veteran by the name of Bill Gilbert, who's not from Kingsburg originally, the other side of the country. You're a Jersey boy, do I have that right?
You got that right.
And I guess if you grow up in New Jersey, so close to the Atlantic shore, you've got no choice but to end up in the Navy, right? I mean, they're going to kick you out if you join the Army.
That's true.
Tell me about growing up there in New Jersey, and one day in particular. I like to ask so many veterans about this. December 7th, 1941. Do you remember where you were, what you were doing, and how you found out about the attacks on Pearl Harbor?
I sure do. I was sitting at my breakfast table having breakfast at 7:30 in the morning. And, of course, it was a different time out in Hawaii, but we heard it on the radio, and their life took a turn from there, big turn.
And I understand that breakfast table would figure in largely later on, too, but what did you know immediately that this was going to change your life, that your life was going to take a turn? Did you know right then that you'd end up in the service?
No, I didn't. I didn't join the Navy until November 1942, which was about almost a year later. And I joined on November 6, 1942, which was almost to the day, a year to the day. Mm-hmm. And from there on, it was all Navy.
And you made the choice to enlist in the Navy as opposed to being drafted?
Oh, yes, I enlisted.
Why did you make that decision? What prompted you to do that?
Couldn't see myself in foxholes up to my neck in water.
So you'd rather be on a ship in the Pacific getting shot at?
Right, that's true.
Well, tell me about that journey. I know you served on a couple different ships of a couple different classes and had some different kinds of duties, but when you first got in the Navy, what did you hope to be doing? What were your expectations? I'm sure it was what you ended up doing was not exactly what you thought you'd be doing.
Well, at that time, the Navy gave you a choice of what you wanted to be or school you wanted to go to. And I decided I'd like to be a radioman aircraft. So I signed up for that. But when I got in, I guess my aptitude test showed me better suited for a spelling of some kind because I was good at spelling. And so they stuck me in the communications, mm-hmm. naval communications aboard ship. And my buddy that joined with me, he went into a Navy radio school.
So you got to keep that parallel life thing and figure out what you would have been doing had you gone that direction?
No, I haven't had a parallel situation whatsoever. I didn't wind up with any. Unfortunately, the Navy signalman is a Navy rate, and you can't do much with it outside of the service. There's not much to do with it.
But you did have a lot to do in the service with it. Tell me about what kinds of things you did, and was that something you picked up quickly, or it took a while to grasp?
Went to Chicago University. It was a 6-month course. I wasn't doing too good on reading the blinker light. And I was always felt as if I was about a minute behind. And you can read blinker light about 16 words a minute. Radio, you can get about 45 words with your ears, 45 words a minute.
So when you say blinker light, this is Morse code you're talking about?
Morse code, yes. Mm-hmm. And I always felt I was about a minute behind. So I asked the representative there when we came to graduate how I was doing. He said, well, he says, except for the light, he says, you're doing fine. He says, you're about a minute behind. I said, can I catch up to you? He says, only if we put you back another grade. So he put me back a grade, gave me another 2 weeks of training in signal school, and I passed. And from there on, the ship's crew went to Norfolk, Virginia. They call it a nucleus training class for ship's crew. We're all assigned to the same ship. We got down in Norfolk, Virginia after school. That was about June of 1943. The ship that we were supposed to get was built in Camden, New Jersey, and the hull came down with welds on the deck about 2 inches thick. They were stumbling over the welds in the deck, so they scrapped it all. And they reassigned us to a ship out on the West Coast, which was being built in Maryland, California. And that's where I picked up this first ship, was destroyer DE-30 USS Martin.
Another good example that there's always a curveball coming at wartime. You never know what to expect. And another thing that you figured out since the war was that there was something else going on in Chicago while you were there. I'm sure you had no idea at the time. But underneath Soldier Field at that time is when the great scientists of America and beyond were figuring out this atomic bomb thing. Tell me, in the years since, what you've been able to figure out about what was happening there and your relation to it.
Well, in 1943, January 43, when we got there, winter, we heard this noise under the stadium, but we never knew what it was. It was a whirring sound, and they told us some fantastic story. I don't remember what it was now, but we'd question it, but nobody came up with any answers. But they put us on a watch of fire watch, they called it, and we'd walk around those stadiums with nightsticks for a fire guard, but we didn't realize it was a safety guard, you know, a security watch.
So you guys were all on a need-to-know basis, and none of you needed to know what you were guarding, but you were guarding something.
Yeah, and the radio schools there had Liberty overnight. They wouldn't allow this signal school to have Liberty overnight because they wanted a bed check every night about 10 o'clock. We had to be in the barracks at 10 o'clock. And it used to burn us up because we couldn't figure out why.
Well, and I guess the reason why was they wanted to guard against any possibility of a spy or someone figuring out what they were doing there?
You got that right, yes. That's what it was. And we didn't find this out until after the war. After the war, my brother-in-law and I went back to the school to take a couple of pictures of the school, and there was a plaque on the wall that says, this is where the atomic bomb was built, you know. And so then we put two and two together what was happening.
That had to be some kind of moment when you figure that out, that this was my life and this is what was going on, and this is an event eventually that changed the world and changed history. How big of a moment was that for you, and how big did your eyes get when you figured it out?
The atomic bomb saved my life because I would have been on my way to Japan as an amphibious force signalman. I was headed for new construction on the West Coast. I was home on leave at the time, and I had to report back to San Pedro in California for new construction, which would have been an amphibious ship going to Japan for the initial invasion of the Japanese islands. So when the bomb went off, I was sitting at my table having breakfast where I was when the war started. And I called about 2 days later, I called the naval base in San Pedro and asked them what I should do. They said, just stay there and we'll give you some orders. About 3 weeks later, they sent me orders because I had so many points built up from being overseas. I was way above the points I needed to get out, so they just sent me a telegram telling me to report to Lido Beach, New York, for discharge. So that's how I got discharged in 1945. I was one of the first ones out.
You were there in Chicago when the bomb was being built. It saved your life. You're sitting at your breakfast table, the same place you were before the war started when you heard about Pearl Harbor. But in between those two times at your breakfast table, did you do anything worth telling me about?
Overseas all those times. Between the two breakfasts in 42 and breakfast in 45, I was overseas.
And we're going to hear all about that from Bill Gilbert, his time on a couple different ships during World War II, the USS Martin and the USS Banner. We're going to hear all about it when Hometown Heroes continues next. You're listening to Newstalk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Well, you recognize Anchors Away because our guest today is a Navy veteran of World War II. Bill Gilbert of Kingsburg will be 87 in November, but many Novembers ago, he was serving in the Pacific on a destroyer, the USS Martin, in the early days, or kind of the middle days, I guess, of World War II. Now, what were your duties on the Martin? You talked about being a signalman and communication among ships, which I guess is pretty crucial with the number of ships and the number of lives that are at stake.
Yes, I was with. We operated with Task Force 58, which was a fast-moving task force of four carriers, four battleships, four cruisers, 13 destroyers in a fleet, and we were from one end of the Pacific to the other. We made raids on all the Gilbert Islands, the Marshall Islands, Truk, which was the Japanese Pearl Harbor. We made the initial landing, or initial raid on Truk, and with a fleet. And as you know, it turned that war around at that time. But then the destroyer was assigned as officially to escort duty. So most of our work came with escorting big carriers and big cruisers and big battleships to different areas of the Pacific. So that's what our duty was. Task Force 58 was a fast-moving ship, and my job was to take communications from the lead ship, which was always a carrier, flags, signals from the flag. You had to coordinate your ship's operation. The signal crew operated at night. You had to turn, the signal crew took all the signal hoist messages from the main ship, so that at night when you made a turn, those coordinated signals had to be a time signal, so that when a certain time came along, all the ships turned at the same time, which meant crucial reading of those flags. And if you made one mistake, you wound up in a wreck with ships that were turning in the wrong direction at night. And there was no other communication at night except flags. No lights, no nothing. You had darkness. And the only other was TBS, which they never used because it could be picked up by the enemy. But flag hoists and signals could not.
And how many people aboard your ship were responsible for this? Were you the only one? Did you have other guys with you doing the same thing?
That's another thing that when this ship went into commission, we were supposed to have in the communication gang a chief signalman, a first-class signalman, 2 seconds, and 3 third-class signalmen, and 3 strikers, which was a good complement of about 10 signalmen. When we went aboard ship, we had 1 chief, 1 first-class, and 3 signalmen, strikers. I was one of the strikers, at the lowest on the ship, seaman first, when we went aboard ship. The chief, on the way to from San Francisco to Honolulu, he thought he was going to get a transfer. So he put in for at sick bay for a transfer for tuberculosis. They transferred him, which left us with no chief, no first class, just 3 signalmen strikers. And who do you think wound up to be the lead signalman?
I have no idea. Who could that possibly be?
Me. Which was a responsibility for me. It's 19 years old. Very, very tough job. And we had to make sure that the communications that you had four hours on and 4 hours off, night and day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And that got to be really tough.
I believe it. That's a lot of responsibility for a 19-year-old kid. And is that something you allowed yourself to think about, or did you try to keep it out of your mind, this idea that here's this very expensive ship that the U.S. Navy has and a whole bunch of lives on it, and in a big way, you're responsible for all of it?
That's right. Exactly right.
Is that something you allowed yourself to think about, or did you try not to?
I tried not to. It was a real chore.
I believe it. Now, as far as the mechanics of these communications between ships, where was your station on your destroyer? And were you looking through field glasses, the binoculars, to see the other ship's flag? How does that work?
They called it a long glass. It's about 2 feet long, and you'd rest it on a light on a searchlight and read the signals off of that main ship, which we called the Senior Officer Present Afloat, SOPA, we called it. Senior Officer Present Afloat was the main ship in charge of the task force. And everything that came off of that ship, you had a came across by blinker light in the daytime and flags in the daytime, nothing at night. So the signal's job at night was just main watch, just watching.
I'm sure when you think about all the time that you spent in the war on that ship and on another ship, that's a lot of communications to receive and probably some. Did you ever have to send any messages to or only receive?
They all had to be relayed from one ship to another. Uh-huh. And the on the second ship that I had was a landing craft. We had 15 landing boats. They had all the ship's communications from the ship to shore had to be handled through that bridge. And the signals for each individual boat, in order to get that boat from the ship with the crew, with the Marines and soldiers on it, in order to get that boat into the beach, you had to go through coral reefs. Well, coral reefs are dangerous for the bottom of a boat. You can they tear the boat, they tear the bottom out of a boat. So all those coral reefs had to be blown up before we'd send a boat through. And the signalman's job was to make sure that you'd have a signalman ashore, a signalman on a ship, and the communication had to direct that boat through that opening where the frogman blew the coral reef apart so that it wouldn't tear the bottom out of a boat.
And you were at one of the landings where that lesson was learned and that the Marines paid a heavy price for at Tarawa, which I want to talk to you about. And we're going to talk about all the days you spent working with landing craft. Pardon me. But I'm curious, with all those messages that you had to relay, and anybody that's ever played the game of telephone knows you take a message in and you put it out. It doesn't always come out the same way it came in. What do you think your percentage was for getting the message correctly, passing it on correctly, and were there ever any instances where the message didn't come across right that that maybe stand out because of what happened because of it?
Fortunately, in visual communications, they had a message called an IMI. You repeated your message. They did not understand it. You'd have to repeat it. And never a message gone through that somebody didn't repeat something and had to understand it. So the, and then they used to put out news broadcasts too, with the from ship to ship. The senior officer president of float used to put out a news bulletin that had to be relayed from ship to ship too, which was quite a long story from ship to ship, and it gave you all the information on what was happening. So the signalman aboard ship knew exactly what was going on throughout the war, and that's if you want the true story on what happened. Find a sailorman to tell you. He knows what happened.
Well, was that a part of your daily life, sailors coming up to you and asking you what was going on?
Oh, yes, yes. You know, very, very. And we had to be very diligent on what we told them, too. Couldn't always give them the true story, you know.
Well, I'm sure some of those messages that you're relaying are matters of security that you can't pass on.
That's true, yes.
Are there any commands, directives, situations, you know, instructions that came to you that really stand out in your mind where, because I'm sure the routine instruction is just routine and you get used to it, but there had to be a few that were out of the ordinary that really got your attention or stand out in your mind.
Not really. The real important ones, we never seen. Mm-hmm. You know, you'd never hear them. That was communicated by the captain going from one ship to another. So anything where the captain had a something that couldn't be relayed to the crew, and they'd have meetings aboard ships out there. So anything like that wasn't given to the crew members.
Something tells me that maybe weather could impact your ability to do your job. Is that an accurate assessment?
Yeah, I went through two tornadoes. I've seen a tornado so bad that it tore a 36-inch searchlight, which is a big searchlight. There's one on each side of naval ships for communications. They're called incandescent lights that bounce the signal off of a cloud.
Right.
You can aim it at a cloud and send a signal a ship across the horizon or a ship you can't even see can read it off the clouds. We use those only in a dire emergency. But that ship, that tornado, tore those searchlights right off of the ship, took the whaleboats off of the Davids, what we call the things that hold the boats up, tore the Davids right off, tore depth charges off the back of a ship. Then these are all welded to the deck, you know, and if they could do that to the deck, they could, what it could do to your body.
And I'm assuming that in your role as a signalman, you're pretty much a topside guy, right? You spent most of your time above, on top of the ship?
All the time a top ship was called a signal bridge, which is right under the top deck, called a conning bridge. Right. That was above the signal bridge, and then the signal bridge, and then the main deck. So you had you were always outside on the deck. I used to tie myself to the railing, standing up so that I wouldn't be washed overboard sometimes.
Wow, now that sounds like there's some stories there. And I guess when you're that high up, you do a little rocking and rolling when the weather comes. Were there ever any moments where it was so bad that you thought, this might be it, I'm going to end up in the drink somewhere?
Yes, if you take a 70-degree roll, you can turn that ship over. We lost 13 destroyers like that out in the Pacific by rolling over from storms. All hands gone. 13. You never hear about that, though.
What would you say was the closest that you came where you felt, you know, I know I'm tied to this thing, but if it goes over, that being tied to it's not going to do me any good.
If it went over, whether you were tied or not, you were dead.
Are there any moments that really stand out where you remember actually fearing for your life or feeling like you weren't going to be waking up the next morning?
Yeah, many nights during that storms, those two storms, it was very, very, well, we were all scared, you know. And if it wasn't for the captain, we would have lost that ship many times. But the captain knew how to ride those waves out. He knew how to put that ship into the wind, as they called it. And if that ship would have broached to either side of that wave, lost. It could be any ship could be lost. And you can't really blame the captain because you never know what that ocean's going to do. That current can shift all of a sudden and hit you the wrong way, and there goes your ship.
Yeah, and there's something about the enemy that if the enemy's going to do something to you, you kind of expect that. But the weather is the unexpected. Mother Nature probably was a bigger enemy to you than the Japanese at some times.
I think you're right there. We were more scared sometimes with the weather.
In that situation, not to belabor the point, but when you're in the midst of one of those storms and you're holding on for dear life, what's going through your mind? I mean, do you have your eyes closed? Praying? Are you trying to think about something happy somewhere? What's going on in your mind?
You try to get in, you know, what I would do when I knew the storm was going to hit, I'd go into the wheelhouse, which was enclosed, and dog down, we called them dogs, would dog down the doors so that the wind couldn't take the doors off of the hinges, you know. And if it got behind that door for any reason at all, it would tear that door right off. So you had to dog yourself into some area where you were secure. And that's where most of the signal crew and the captains and on bad weather that would go to the wheelhouse.
Now, I know we're going to have lots to talk about as far as your work with landing craft and some of the landings that you were involved in. But as far as your time on the destroyer, you mentioned that task force and all the different ships in it. And you mentioned doing escort duty. Now, it seems to me, if my understanding of the way things worked back then is correct, that the most expendable ships in those circumstances were the destroyers, right?
You got that right. You took everything that was coming at you so that that the battleships and the cruisers and the carriers were safe. The destroyers were expendable.
So did you get fired upon or attacked at any point during that time on the destroyer?
Not in my ship. We were too small to worry about. They were after the big stuff. You know, if Kamikaze, for instance, came at you, they wouldn't go for you. They'd go for the big ships. If you got hit, you were hit because you were in the way.
And I'm sure there were guys on your ship that were trying to shoot down those Kamikazes so they wouldn't get to the big ships.
Correct, yes.
Anything else about your time on the Martin, the destroyer, that you want to share before we move on after the commercial to your days on the USS Banner?
Oh, I think that was fine on the destroyer I loved to be on. She was more exciting than the APA that I had. She was more into more things that were vital to the war. She was a fighting ship. The APA was a transport that took in troops to the landing craft, and the troops were the ones that done the dirty work. But on a destroyer, you had the whole thing yourself. You had to operate the ship. You had to make sure communications on the ship was operating correctly, and you were going to get there where you were going and do what you had to do. The firepower, any man that was like a signalman, he couldn't wave flags at the enemy. He was assigned to a gun during actual combat. So each signalman that weren't available for communication had to go man a gun. So I was assigned to a gun, a 20 millimeter. We fired that at planes. I never got hit, though. I was very fortunate.
Did you ever hit anything you were firing at?
That I don't know. I know I hit myself.
Well, there's got to be a story there. I'll tell you what, let's get that when we come back. We need to take another brief break, but we'll get that story. It sounds like a good one from Bill Gilbert when Hometown Heroes continues next on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. My guest today, a Navy veteran of World War II, Bill Gilbert of Kingsburg. He'll be 87 in November. You can tell, though, his memory's still pretty sharp. And before the break, he started to tell us about an instance where he was manning a gun on the destroyer, the USS Martin, and somehow got himself. Didn't know if he shot anything else, but tell me that story, Bill. How'd you hurt yourself?
I was firing a 20 millimeter gun, and the gun, shell, 20 millimeter shell, exploded about 2 or 3 feet out of the gun, and the gun sight that you're looking through has an opening in between the gun sight and the gun, and the shrapnel came through, hit me in the chest, and they pulled out shrapnel out of my chest for about 2 or 3 days.
And I'm sure your fellow sailors gave you a real hard time about that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they thought I shot myself. I don't know how the heck it happened, but that's what it was. I wound up in sick bay for a couple of days, you know.
Well, and I'm sure there's been a day or two in the years since that you thought back about that and said, wow, that could have done a lot more than throw a few shards in my chest.
That's true. I don't know what we were firing at. It seems to me it was not a plane. I don't know what it was that we were firing at. I don't know. I don't remember. That's how fuzzy it was, you know.
Well, I don't blame you. And I want to ask you a little bit more about your time on the destroyer, because later on you would be involved in a ship that sent landing craft to beaches across the Pacific. But while still on the destroyer, you were at the first island that the Americans took back at a very heavy cost, the island of Tarawa. Some people would say Tarawa, a lot of different pronunciations, but anyway you slice it, it's been called 1 square mile of hell. We've seen the picture of the red surf next to the beaches and heard the stories about the enemy being so dug in and the Americans not being prepared for that. And another lesson was learned there as far as how you would land troops on beaches later, because they didn't know to blow up the reefs yet at that point. What do you remember about what you saw of Tarawa, and was it hard to see what you saw there?
Yes, it was hard to see because we were, you know, I said, destroyer can't get in that close. And all we could do was get in there for bombardment, you know, at that time. But the troops that from other ships that were going through, they were getting about 30 yards from the beach. They couldn't get to the beach. And we didn't know that the coral reefs at that time were that bad around any of the islands. And so we had to learn how to do that. And then the crossfire that was coming from the one end of the island to the other was like a horseshoe. And the Japs were dug in on one end of the horseshoe, and we were coming in from the other end. So the ones that were landing in the middle had to go through crossfire in order to get to the beach. And that's something that we should have never have done. We should have come in some other way, you know. And the bombarding of the island itself, we bombarded with everything from cruisers to battleships to destroyers, and as for two or three days before the troops landed, we thought we would hit something. We didn't think that they were dug in that deep that they couldn't. We wouldn't hit anything. Well, we didn't hit anything, and there was a lot of guys lost because of it. And so, understanding what was happening before the invasion was of vital importance, and we didn't know until the second island. Then we learned what to do.
Well, and we hear about the bloody battles that came later on, like Iwo Jima and Okinawa, and you have to think that they could have been even worse had some of those lessons not been learned early on in a place like Tarawa.
That's true.
So you spent about 9 months on that destroyer, the Martin. How did you end up moving off of that ship and onto the APA 60, the Banner?
After the truck invasion, or truck bombardment and raid, the ship was assigned to escort duty to a battleship and a tanker. And we had to escort them from the truck island all the way to Florida Island, which is right across from Guadalcanal in the Solomons. And we got down to the Solomons, and communications came aboard ship that we were supposed to transfer a certain amount of people for new construction back to the States. Well, I had applied for new construction, and Captain came to me one day, and he says, Billy says, we're going to transfer you to this island for new construction. He says, have your gear ready and go. So pack it up. I packed up all my gear, and within 15 minutes, I was ashore at Florida Island, which was a little island that we had taken about 6 months before, with a lot of loss of life at Florida Island. And Florida Island has a peculiar smell to it, like flowers. It's a beautiful smell to it. You know, you could smell it 300 yards from the shore, out at sea. And I thought, boy, this is going to be some duty, you know.
You thought you were going to get to stay there for a while, have a little vacation?
I thought so. When I got there, the captain put me off ashore and wished me good luck. No pay accounts, no nothing. I didn't have anything but myself with me. And got ashore and found the barracks. A day later, they came to me and they said, Bill, we're going to put you on this signal tower for communications. He says, you're a signalman, right? I said, no, I'm not. I'm a seaman first. Because I knew if I said I was a signalman, I'd be stuck there from now till hell froze over, you know, and I wouldn't get off of the island. So I said I was a seaman first. But I knew how to signal. So they put me on the signal. They wanted me to go up on the signal tower. And fortunately, my transfer came through to Guadalcanal. So I transferred they took me by boat over to Guadalcanal. And my records indicate that I was supposed to go to the nearest West Coast receiving station. So an Army transport came in about 2 weeks later. It's in Guadalcanal and took us aboard ship. 21 days on that ship, on that Army transport. It was an armed guard armed guard meant that there was controlled by the Army, but run by the communications and the signals were all controlled by the Navy. We had a Navy armed guard aboard ship. Mm-hmm. So when I went up the gangplank of that ship, I was carrying a sea bag. And the sea bag hit the stanchion going up the gangplank, going up the gangway, and knocked the sea bag into the drink. Oh. So I lost all my gear. Everything I owned was in that sea bag. And I was carrying a duffel bag on the other side. All I saved was the duffel bag with my shaving gear and stuff in it. But all my clothes and everything went down the drink. Still there on the bottom of the bay, I imagine.
Some scuba divers are in for a surprise one of these days. So pick up your journey from there.
I contacted the signal gang on the ship and asked them if they needed some help. So, and they couldn't believe that I was coming off the beach in a Marine uniform. And in the Navy, because I had lost all my gear, you know, have anything. So they welcomed me aboard ship, which meant that I got better food. We ate with the crew members instead of the the troops, which was a lot better because that below deck was a hot area. There was no air conditioning in those days. You had to stay below decks, and it was hot. So when I was aboard ship, I was up on the bridge. So I worked my way back on the Army transport to San Francisco. Got off at Pier 92, and I had a contact, Treasure Island at the time, for transportation back to Treasure Island. So I seen a destroyer on another pier there in San Francisco. I walked over and I asked the guy if I could send a signal to go to Goat Island and have him pick me up. Have transportation sent over from Treasure Island to pick me up. So they said okay. So well, here comes a big limousine, and they were expecting to pick up a Navy officer. So the guy says, "Who am I supposed to pick up here?" I said, "You're supposed to pick me up." And well, they dropped me off. I took a big ribbon for that because here I am in a limousine coming into
Mr. Big Shot.
Mr. Big Shot coming into Treasure Island, you know. So I kind of enjoyed that that reception. But from there, I went back home on a 30-day leave and came back to San Francisco after 30 days. It was assigned to the second ship here, which is the USS Banner. Picked her up in San Pedro, new construction.
The Banner's role as an APA was to take all these landing craft around, send them into the shore with troops, with Marines mostly, and Army infantry people.
Well, we never knew what we were getting. Could be Marines, could be Army, could be anybody. But usually the ones that, for a specific island, they had Marines all the time on the first part of the landing. But the Army usually took over after that, you know. And wherever the Army was stationed, we had to bring them in just the same as we did the Marines. But the Marines got the credit for the landings.
Well, and we're going to get your role in some of those landings when we come back. We'll take our final break here on Hometown Heroes. Come back with the rest of my conversation with Bill Gilbert today. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. As usual, the time goes by way too fast, and it has again today with Bill Gilbert of Kingsburg, who's really shed some light on the role of a signalman in the Navy in the Pacific during World War II. When we left off, he had transferred on to the APA 60, the Banner, which was sending landing craft to beaches all over the Pacific. And in that role as a signalman, I suppose there are a couple different places you can end up. You can stay on ship or you can volunteer to go ashore because communication has to run both ways there, right?
Correct. The amphibious forces usually had to have signalmen trained for that particular work aboard ship and also landing craft. Usually you got your training from landing craft and then you progressed to the ship. So I was assigned as ship's company to the original construction of the ship, which meant that I came from the ship itself, not for the landing craft. Landing craft was controlled by a specific officer who was trained to train just those specific signalmen that need to be trained in signals from ship to shore. And the signalmen, if they were shorter-handed, you'd take over anybody's duties because you had to have a signalman ashore in order to communicate and signalman on the ship. So that's one of the chores that we were assigned to do.
So oftentimes you'd get the first landing craft in there and they'd have a signalman with them who would stay ashore and go back and forth with whoever's on the ship to coordinate the landing craft coming in. Now, earlier you said that you liked it when you were on the destroyer because you're kind of in the middle of everything. Does that mean you actually volunteered to go ashore and be a little closer to the action in some of these situations?
You didn't volunteer anything. you get in that boat and go. You're assigned to a boat. You got to take that responsibility. If they were shorter-handed on the amphibious forces for the landing craft, you had to replace them. There was no specific job that you couldn't handle in communications. When you're trained as a signalman, you got to handle everything.
I just assume that it's a little more comfortable when you stay aboard the ship than when you're heading into shore.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Were there any times where you went to shore where things got a little hairy or you got a little anxious?
Not too many times, but enough to make you scared. You know, you were always scared aboard ship, and also ashore, because they could hit you just as well aboard ship as they could on the beach.
But when you're there on the beach, signaling back to the ship to get all these landing craft in with the troops, how long would you end up staying there? And did you ever wish that that time were a little shorter?
It was just the initial landing, initial boats coming into the beach, where you were afraid that you would get hung up on the coral reefs. Once they found the opening, then the crews of the boats knew where to go, and they marked the channel so that boats could come through. But the first one was always the hairiest one, first boat through, because the frogman had to do a job opening up that coral reef, because those reefs were terrible. They'd tear the bottom right out of a boat.
And you had seen firsthand what can happen when you don't blow up those reefs and you get hung up on them. And some of the places where you were with the banner included Okinawa, which a lot of people forget about how bloody that was, and more lives lost there than just about anywhere.
Just to make sure you understand, Okinawa was an easy landing. It was Okinawa after half an hour on the beach that was bad. So the initial landing was Okinawa was great. I mean, we didn't have any opposition whatsoever. So that was one of the easy ones as far as the Navy was concerned. But the initial landing of Tarawa, Iwo Jima, Leyte, the Leyte landing was terrific. That was one of the main in the Philippines.
Yep.
If the Philippine Sea was one of the biggest naval engagements of the war. And what we did at Leyte was the turning point of the war in the Pacific. That was the main goal that the Japs were trying to hold on to. And we made landings at Lingayen Gulf, which was worse than Okinawa. Lingayen Gulf is in Luzon in the Philippines. Manila was also, Manila Bay itself was dangerous, very dangerous. A lot of people don't realize that, but that was where we met a lot of opposition in the city of Manila. I seen lines of all the buildings had their tops blown off. There wasn't a building in Manila that didn't have their top off of it. And people were living in the mountains. And some of the communications between the ships in Manila Bay were dangerous because there were so many sunken ships in the bay, you couldn't get close to Manila, you know, and so it was dangerous all the way through, no matter where you went.
Well, and we've already discussed how the atomic bomb saved your life, and you were sitting at your breakfast table in New Jersey when you heard the news about that before you would have had to be deployed back to the Pacific and end up near mainland Japan. But when you were heading back to the States after some of those engagements you just talked about, you unknowingly crossed over one of the great tragedies in World War II in the Pacific. Tell me what you've been able to piece together about where you were in relation to the USS Indianapolis.
We didn't know. At that time, we didn't know where we were going, but we were told to prepare for going back to the States sooner or later. So when we were heading back, we had to cross through the area where the Indianapolis was sunk by a submarine right before the end of the war. It was in July of 1945, and we were on our way back from the islands, from Leyte, through that area. We must have passed right over those guys that were in the water. That ship went down in 13 minutes, had no communications. That's how fast it went down. Those men were in the water for 5 days. We must have passed right over those fellas. And I feel so bad for not being on a better watch, because we thought the war was almost over. You know, we knew that Japan was had nothing to fight with, and so when we were going back to the States, we figured that would be the end of it. But we didn't realize that those men were in the water, and that they were so many of them.
And so many of them, as people who know the story know, were killed by sharks in the area. So you think in retrospect that had some people aboard ship been taking a closer watch of the surroundings, that maybe something could have been spotted?
Oh, sure, yeah. We didn't realize at that time that our watches were that important, even at the end of the war. Who would think that a submarine or a ship that size, which was a great big ship. I mean, that was a heavy ship. That torpedo had to hit the right spot on that cruiser in order for it to go down.
And of course, we talked about your little connection with the atomic bomb, and it was the ship that had delivered the atomic bomb to Tinian, where the Enola Gay took it and dropped it. So I guess if it had been sunk before, then maybe we wouldn't be having this conversation right now. But, I want to ask you, Bill, just a couple minutes left here. When you think back of all your time in the war on both the ships and all the battles that you endured in the different situations, do you look back on one circumstance and say, you know, that was the closest call, that was the closest I came to be one of the guys that didn't come home from the war?
Very close. I was surprised I made it. In fact, I can't believe it yet that I'm 87, almost 87 years old, still alive.
Was there anything else that you haven't shared that you'd like to share with our audience about your time in the Navy?
I think you covered a lot of it, and I'm fortunate to just being able to talk to and converse with you on it. Thanks for the radio station for being able to broadcast this. I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you. Thank you for serving our country and for telling me a little bit more about it. And I just have one more question. Do you still think in Morse code?
Yes. I sure do.
So all those times you've blinked at me during our conversation, I should have been picking something up?
No, I doubt it.
All right. It's been a lot of fun today with Bill Gilbert of Kingsburg. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.